and welcome again to the Ask Beattie Show. And isn't it the truth that whether or not we are famous or whether or not we are in the mental health profession, that we all go through so many ups and downs in our life? And then the question, of course, becomes is that when we are suffering, for example, there are 16 million adults in the United States who are suffering, yes, truly suffering from clinical depression. And I suspect that that number is really a low number. 40 million adults suffering from a variety of different anxiety disorders, which is now the number one mental health issue in the United States. And what about the substance abuse issues and the relationship problems? We talk and talk and talk about all of the difficulties that people are having in their relationships. Divorce rate for first marriages, 48%. So what happens? What happens when we marry for the second time? Well, that number goes up to 63%. And most people would think that they've learned something from marriage number one, marriage number two, a variety of different kinds of relationships. So what happens? What happens when we choose to marry again the third time? Well, that statistic, the divorce statistic, goes up, my friends, to 72%. So you have to ask yourself, so what have we learned? Have we been really willing to acknowledge and address and resolve our own issues and try to figure out what is it about us where we continue to choose the wrong man or the wrong woman over and over and over again? And it is so easy to blame everyone, our parents, our family. And it is so true that many people have grown up in incredibly dysfunctional families where there was abuse of various different kinds, whether or not we're talking about verbal abuse or emotional abuse or physical abuse or sexual abuse. And I guess that my position, and I'm not blaming victims, I'm not blaming women, and I'm not blaming men, but I believe that we all have a responsibility to try to get our own house in order. And I must say that very recently, I have to tell you what's been going on in my private practice here in very, very hot and humid New York City and in East Hampton. I've gotten a number of referrals. Now, I have to mention, of course, that access to mental health in this country is certainly difficult. Even if you have insurance, even if you have mental health benefits, and so many people do not have sufficient mental health benefits. But recently, referrals have come from lawyers and doctors who have referred their clients and their patients, people who we read about in the newspaper, people who have no issues with money, people who one would believe, of course, we never know what goes on behind closed doors, that their lives are really terrific. One woman, a movie star in her late 50s, all kinds of issues, substance abuse issues, domestic violence problems. So I met her a couple of times, and it appeared that she was finally ready to start to seriously deal with her own issues before entering yet another potentially toxic relationship. And yet, she wasn't serious. She wasn't serious. Another couple, they met with me for a couple of sessions. Significant problems. He had substance abuse problems. She had control issue problems. Their relationship had been on a roller coaster ride and a merry-go-round ride for years and years and years. So she heard me speak at a presentation, and she said to me, she said, "Beattie, at this point in my life, life. I am in my early 50s. I want to get it right. So that was a wonderful, wonderful sign that this was a woman. And then I met her husband, and he also was tired of the roller coaster ride, the unhappy roller coaster ride that never seemed to end. So what do you think happened? We met. There seemed to be a terrific connection between them and me, and they too dropped the ball. They dropped the ball. And then a couple of days ago, actually, it's been a very busy couple of weeks of new referrals. I get a call from a physician in Los Angeles who is referring a woman who we've read about in the newspapers for years and years and years. She used to be in politics, and her physician was telling me that she was in an extraordinarily abusive relationship, verbally abusive, emotionally abusive, and physically and sexually abusive as well. So the doctor says, look, you're in New York City, but this woman is certainly able to come to New York and work with you on a regular basis. And I'm thinking, this is really good. This is a woman who, you know, by all appearances, you would think that she has it all. She's beautiful. She's smart. She's rich. She seemed to be somebody who really and truly had her life together in all respects. But as a therapist, you know, who's been in the field now for over 35 years, and I have treated people from every socioeconomic background, every religion, people who are gay and straight and trans and queer, and I think I've kind of seen it all. And what this has all taught me is that nobody ever knows what really goes on behind closed doors. And I think that when people start therapy, for a lot of people, it's very embarrassing to be revealing and acknowledging to themselves and acknowledging to a therapist that life actually is not what it appears to be. So I called this former politician, and we had a very lengthy initial consultation on the phone. And I might say that she sounded that she had been drinking, and then she went into a lot of details about this incredibly, incredibly toxic marriage that she has been in for the last couple of years. So I said, okay. I said, you're going to come to New York, and perhaps we could find another meeting place if that was not going to be convenient. And she promised to text me the next day so that we were going to set up some appointments so that she could finally begin to acknowledge, address, and resolve her issues. Well, I heard from her just like you heard from her. So this morning, I actually called the doctor who referred her to me. And I said, look, you know, we talked, she appeared, and of course that was really the key word, she appeared that she was someone who was serious. Finally, she was at a point where her husband was actually physically attacking her, and we shall see whether or not this woman is going to finally follow through, and when is enough enough? So, you know, I've been thinking, it's like, what do we have to do as a society? What do we have to do in our educational system to be able to convince people that reaching out and asking for help is actually a really, really positive thing to do? Because when you think about it, we ask for help in all kinds of areas in our life, virtually in all areas of our life. We have a problem with our hair. We have a problem with our teeth. I mean, we do not hesitate. And yet there is still a huge stigma when it comes to mental health that people are really reluctant, that they are reluctant to do the work and to get their lives on track. And another thing that I have learned over the years is that we can't force anybody to do this. So that if you are in a relationship with someone and the person is saying, I don't want to do anything, I'm going to continue to use drugs, I'm going to continue to take pills, I'm going to continue to do whatever it is that I want to do, all we can do, the best that we can ever do, is encourage people. And in the final analysis, people need to make their own decisions. You know, Gary Null has talked about a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. And I keep wondering, what is it that we can do so that people will not be so fearful of knowing, whether or not we're talking about Donald Trump, whether or not we're talking about our physical health, whether or not we are talking about our mental health? Because when you have situations where people really know, they know that their lives are not going well, they know that they need to do something about their physical health, including eating plant-based diets and exercising and having supportive people in your life and eliminating toxins, chemical toxins, including toxic people that can absolutely make us crazy. We know this. We hear about this all the time, over and over and over again. And yet Gary Null talks about intentional ignorance and intentional neglect. And the bottom line is, for all of us, and think about it, if we want to master something, we find a way to do it. So basically, we master what we want to master. And I'm someone, as a therapist, as I probably go overboard and over to the top in trying to convince people to engage in constructive behavior, to engage in having constructive, positive relationships in their lives, and to stop the self-sabotaging and to stop engaging, in behaviors and in relationships that are destructive and self-destructive. And again, I have to tell myself this all the time, especially, you know, when I'm meeting people, as I do on a regular basis, who are not serious. They are not serious about doing the work. And I oftentimes will say, you know, what more can I do to motivate people to be able to take care of their current business and to take care of their, what I call, their skeletons in the closet? We all have skeletons in the closet and old unfinished business. And the reality is that unless we are willing, unless we are serious about emotionally working through what happened, what didn't happen in our family of origin, working through as best as we can, even though we can't change history, the physical abuse, the verbal abuse, the relationships that we've been through over and over again that have caused us nothing but pain. And unless people are serious, really serious about doing the work, their lives and their relationships are going to continue. They're going to continue to be depressing and upsetting. And I used to always say that I wish that there was a way to fast forward the crisis. And yet I've seen, especially in, you know, the last couple of weeks, where the crisis, you wonder, how much worse can these people's situations be, where they have the resources and they have the time to get really good professional help, and that they are dropping the ball on themselves. So if you are somebody right now who's listening to the Ask Beattie Show and you have been hesitant, to reach out and ask for help, of course, you can always call me right here on the show. And the call-in number is 888-874-4888. 888. And now we have a Progressive Radio Network voicemail where you can actually call and you can leave me a message and you can ask me some questions. And that voicemail number is 862-800-6805. Well, I have an absolutely terrific guest, and I wish that she was here in the studio with me right now, but I was so happy to be able to connect with Nona Willis Aronovich. Now, Nona is an American author and editor, and she is the daughter of Ellen Willis and Stanley Aronovich. As of 2017, she was the features editor for Splinter and writing the weekly newsletter Fucking Through the Apocalypse. And Nona is featured in the feminist history film, which I'm really looking forward to watch. She's beautiful when she's angry. She's been a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, worked as an education and poverty reporter at NBC News Digital, and worked as an associate editor at Good Magazine, as well as written for various other publications. So how did I find out about Nona before I'm going to talk with her? Well, in the New York Times in February of this year, I read an article, and it happened to be written by Nona Aronovich. And the headline was, "Don't Let Sex Distract You from the Revolution." Of course, wearing my sex therapy hat, I was very, very curious to find out what this was all about. And some of the things in the article, is love standing in the way of a feminist future? How to date men when you hate men? Radicals made compelling arguments about the destructive, distracting, frankly dangerous power of romance. We shouldn't be sidetracked by sex, which was inconvenient, time-consuming, energy-draining, and irrelevant. And romantic love is a problem, too, according to Ty Grace Atkinson, a radical feminist. So I figured I really needed to talk to Nona about all of this. So Nona, welcome to the Ask Beattie Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So it was quite an article that you wrote, and I really want to know, where are you at? I mean, you don't really believe, do you, that men are the enemy?
No, I mean, I think one of the main questions that we struggle with as modern feminists is how do we incorporate, you know, the men we love into our feminism and our activism. And especially if you're a heterosexual woman, you really struggle with, you know, being true to your politics, but also being true to your feelings. And so that's what kind of led me to this line of inquiry that led to this article in the New York Times, because I was sort of just like, well, at first I saw that book that you mentioned before, How to Date Men When You Hate Men, which is, you know, not a radical feminist text at all, but it really articulated one of the major roadblocks to the fight against patriarchy, which is that we love and are, in some cases, in love with a lot of the men who oppress us. And even if they don't oppress us directly, they oppress us as a class.
But can I just say something? You know, that's true. But do you not feel that we have a personal responsibility to figure out what indeed are the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship? I mean, that's homework. That's a learning curve that I think that we all need to be willing to engage in, so that we are then able to assess, and of course this is my book, how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship, before ending up in a toxic, abusive relationship, or before ending up in a relationship with a man who's a misogynist. I mean, don't you think that we have a role in making these kinds of decisions for ourselves?
Yes, of course. And I think that sometimes people's ingrained misogyny won't show itself until you're in a very specific situation with them. But I think the overarching point of both this article and also your point is that we have to sort of have our emotions on one hand and our logic on the other hand. And sometimes it's really hard to logically choose partners based on how good their politics are. I mean, they might treat us very well, but they might not treat other women in their lives very well, or the opposite. They might have a public persona that really benefits women, but they might exhibit misogynist behavior in our relationships, which can just be so confusing. And it's really not straightforward. I mean, I've struggled with it in my own relationship. The most badass feminists on the face of the earth have struggled with this. You know, Emma Goldman struggled with a lover who drove her completely insane and who, you know, made her feel just that she was a traitor to her own politics. And I've felt like that, too.
You know, one of the things, and I don't know whether you were on the phone for some of my introductory comments, but over the past 35 plus years that I've been practicing as a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, I mean, I've identified the three things. In fact, I go around the country and talk about how to never make a mistake in love again, keeping safe in a Me Too world. That there are three basic things that if we are serious about having a healthy relationship that we have to do. And that the first thing is that we have to get ourselves together. We have a responsibility to deal with our own issues, our own traumas as best as we possibly can, so that the relationship is going to be the icing on the cake, and that we are going to be solid, that we are going to, you know, and be engaging in relationships, not just out of loneliness and need and wanting to be rescued, but that we are as solid as as flawed as we all are, that we are as solid as we can possibly be. And then number two, really learning the ingredients. I mean, in my private practice, especially people who have had a lot of trauma in their lives, and I deal with really smart, lovely people, they're not sure what those ingredients are. And the other thing, and when I finally meet you, I'm going to give you my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. I did research with 450 people and devised a 10-step formula that teaches people how to actually assess all of the things that you are talking about. Now, the fact that I found that it takes about a year to find out who somebody is or isn't, I mean, is another issue. And a lot of people really want to just fast forward the process. But every single thing that you are saying, we are able to see if we open up our eyes and if we have done the work to be able to actually do an accurate assessment. You know, Nicole Brown's Simpson's sister, Denise, you know, she said publicly, and this isn't, you know, just tooting my own horn, that had her sister known the ingredients, she would be alive today. Because in all these domestic violence situations and all of these horrible, horrible relationships, there are typically signs. But if we, you know, don't know what to look for, and if we're needy and lonely and wanting to be rescued, and we make lots and lots of excuses for our partner's disgusting behavior, we find ourselves in a really, really bad place.
Yes, but I don't think it's necessarily as black and white as disgusting behavior versus lovable behavior. I mean, I think there's a real big difference between somebody like Nicole Brown Simpson, which, like, admittedly, she struggled with a lot of what, like, a lot of American women struggle with domestic violence. But then there are also much more subtler instances of just ingrained sort of gender roles that we've all taken on for many years that may not come from a place of malice or violence. That may not show their faces until, say, you have kids or you move in together and you see sort of some unconscious learned behavior that men and women, you know, exhibit when they're in certain domestic situations. So, I mean, of course, if you see signs of somebody being violent, if somebody being really nasty and disgusting to you, that's one thing. But sometimes it's really not as clear cut as that. And I think sometimes a man who consciously knows that these roles are, you know, bogus or socially constructed still unconsciously performs them. And that happens to me as a woman as well. I mean, I have my philosophies of how, you know, what kind of freedom a woman should have in terms of her role in sex and love and motherhood and in her career. And yet sometimes I find myself stuck in the same roles that my mother and grandmother were in. So yes, I mean, obviously to pinpoint violent behavior is a must, but some of these things are so much more insidious.
But I absolutely, you know, agree with you. But if we're not sure, if we're second guessing ourselves, if something doesn't feel right, even though, you know, it's not as blatant as physical violence, I mean, I've been saying for a long, long time that if we're looking at heterosexual relationships, if we're waiting for men to make all the changes, and God knows there are a lot of changes that men certainly do need to be making, but if we're waiting for that to happen, we may wait a really, really long time. I would rather take our power and make sure that if things are not feeling right, whether or not it's in the bedroom or whether or not it's in the boardroom, that we are able to give ourselves permission to do what is in our best interest.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the goal.
And, you know, when I was, you know, reading, you know, your piece on sex, obviously, I loved what your late mom said. You know, a free woman needs a free man. Well, I think as women, we need to be very, very careful, right? That we are choosing free men, and that when we're finding ourselves in compromising situations, that we're going to be willing either to reach out and get some help, or that we're going to be willing to do something. I mean, what do we do if we find ourselves in these kinds of relationships where it may not be violent, but where it is just not okay? I mean, and where if we're expecting the other person to make the changes, it may never happen. So the ball ends up being in our court, don't you think?
Well, first of all, that quote wasn't from my mom. That was from an unnamed woman. That was from a consciousness raising session from like 1968. That was transcribed really early on in the radical women's movement. And that comment was really a very prescient analysis of what ultimately needs to happen with healthy relationships. My mom, on the other hand, I think she really held out for a free man for a long time. She had a couple of serious relationships that for reasons feminist and not feminist did not work out, and finally fell in love with my father, who was not a misogynist to her, wasn't violent or anything like that, but certainly had some internalized sexism, and still does. You know, he's from a certain era,
right?
And I love him dearly, and I think on paper and at rallies, he would be like completely and totally on the right side of all the feminist issues. And yet somebody born in 1933, of course, has internalized some of these expectations that men have. And I think that's true for somebody born in 1984 like me. That said, of course, we have to take responsibility for who we make a life with. And I think I learned that from my mother. And I'm still learning it from her.
I think we're all on a learning curve. And by the way, my husband Jim sends you his love and sends your father sends his love as well. You know, but Nona, I hear in my practice, and I did a panel, of course, as you know, at the Left Forum with Naomi Schneider, sex, sexy, patriarchy, and feminism, and you know, we had a lot of discussion about the anti-male rhetoric. I mean, in my private practice here in New York City, I would say that mostly I'm hearing about how disgusting men are. There, I hear this at least two or three times a week that there are no good men in New York City. all men are disgusting. And here I am, a feminist, okay, and I am saying, look, all men are not Harvey Weinsteins. All men are not Donald Trumps. And I think that we need to, don't you think, really reexamine ourselves and our feelings in general about men. I mean, I rarely hear anything positive about the male population. Do you?
I mean, I think in my crowds, I find people who feel positively about certain men. I mean, I certainly feel positively about certain men. I have wonderful friends and I have a wonderful boyfriend. But, you know, it's interesting that you use Harvey Weinstein and Donald Trump as two examples, because during the whole Me Too movement, what I thought was the most relevant, and I think I told your husband this too, is the Aziz Ansari moment, where, you know, obviously Donald Trump and Harvey Weinstein and Larry Nassar and Bill Cosby, they were sort of larger than life misogynists,
right,
who were you know, really, really openly committing these acts of violence, basically.
Right.
Whereas Aziz Ansari was just acting out accepted behavior that a lot of men had been taught from an early age, which is that you need to badger women and pressure them to have sex with you until they say yes. And I think that was a good example of, you know, a lot of men I've met, not every man. I mean, I've had wonderful sexual experiences, wonderful experiences with men on dates, and the majority of men don't act like that, but it's happened enough in my life, that sort of scenario where a man is pressuring me above my comfort zone, that it really does seem like regular and learned behavior. And while I've never been entangled with somebody like Harvey Weinstein, I've certainly been entangled with somebody like Aziz Ansari. And he's somebody who's loved and respected, and his appeal really lies in his every man persona. And I think that that's more relevant than some of these, you know, big villains.
No, you're absolutely right. And maybe I was really lucky. I was born in Canada in an Orthodox Jewish family. I had a great relationship with a father who taught me at a very young age how to box, how to protect myself. I have not experienced any of this with men. But for the women who do, again, I'm not blaming the women, but let's just suppose you're in bed with a man, and he, again, a heterosexual relationship, wants you to do something that you're not comfortable with. I guess it's not rape. You're not being forced. There isn't a knife at your throat. I mean, do we not need to do a better job in giving women permission and in educating women to be able to say, no, I'm out of here? Let's remove the coercion.
I don't think anybody in the history of rape prevention has claimed that we don't have to empower women to know their needs and desires and wants and be able to say no. Of course, that's part of the problem, that like both men and women learn this paradigm of men as the aggressor and women as the person who acquiesces. I think our whole sensibility needs to change around sex and enthusiastic consent. I think that's a major part of sex education, where people should know that that saying yes shouldn't be just an absence of no, but really, you know, a joyful, enthusiastic affirmation of wanting whatever sex act it is. I mean, I think you need to teach women and people in general about what sex is really for, which is, you know, pleasure and and connection and intimacy, not sort of like a notch on your bedpost. And while I totally respect people who are promiscuous and like identify with the label slut and things like that, I still think there needs to be a baseline of respect for the person you're having sex with and making sure that they're having a good time too. And that goes for both men and women. And I think that if that was really baked into our sex education from an early age, not only in school, but just culturally, then these problems wouldn't be as vast.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, when I think about in my practice, and I see people of all ages, and we're not doing well in the bedroom. And I think that the United States is still a very conservative country in all kinds of ways, but certainly when it comes to sex. And you know, I'll hear all the time that women will say to me, "Well, I'm not comfortable telling him what I really like, or it's painful." And I'll say to them, "Well, you need to speak up. I mean, the man, again, assuming it's a heterosexual relationship, is not a mind reader. And if we're not having a great time, and if it's not joyful, and if it's not satisfying, and if it's not something that we really want to be doing, again, to be able to give ourselves permission to set some boundaries and communicate that this is not okay, this is not working for me," and yet so many people don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the same time, even though men aren't mind readers, they still need to learn skills to how to tune into their partner, and they need to know that you shouldn't be having sex with somebody who doesn't want to have sex with you, and you need to fact gather any information that tells you otherwise. You know, like, I think it's actually not that hard to know whether somebody wants to have sex with you. I mean, I think sometimes these are very gray areas, but most of the time it's a very distinct feeling of this person is ignoring my signals. So I think that that's something that men can work on too. I'm not just going to put it on women.
No, men definitely have to work on a lot of things. But I think that we all need to work on a lot of things when it comes to our relationships and when it comes to our sex lives. I mean, look at the domestic violence figures. I mean, 1 in 3 women every single day, you know, are killed by their so-called intimate partner. So, I mean, we're not doing well. And, you know, the divorce rate for third marriages, Nona, is 72%, 63% for second marriages, 48% for first marriages. You know, I really believe that, look, the schools, and this was something very different in Canada. I ran the school social services program for Greater Montreal with two other colleagues, and we talked about all of these issues beginning in kindergarten. We talked about how to express anger. We talked about good touches and bad touches, and I remember bringing in Marla Thomas's record, you know, Free to Be You and Me. And I think that our educational system, for the most part, has really dropped the ball. I'm not sure if it ever was something that was a focus in American education.
Yeah, I don't think so either. But, you know, I wanted to quibble a little bit about that divorce rate. I think it's so interesting. I love talking about divorce rates because, on one hand, it shows that people are getting married for the wrong reasons and people are in bad marriages, but it also shows that people, especially women, feel that they can leave a marriage if it is bad. I think the low divorce rate before feminism was not necessarily indicative of happy marriages so much as women who felt economically tied to their husbands, felt scared of them, felt like they would be total failures if they got out of that marriage. So I think on one hand, like, yes, we should work on forming lasting relationships if that's what we want. On the other hand, divorce isn't necessarily a failure, and in fact, it can be a triumph. As somebody who's going through divorce myself, it was the best thing I ever did. So I do feel like we should have more of a nuanced conversation about that.
No, I think that that's true. But what, you know, studies have shown is that we typically tend to, unless we've done a lot of self-examination, to end up with the same kind of a person over and over again. I hosted a call-in counseling radio talk show in Rhode Island, and I had a man call me. He said, "Beattie, I've been married 3 times. I married a blonde, a brunette, and a redhead. And basically, you know, in listening to what he had to say, he should have stayed with the first one, because he basically, the only thing he changed was the woman's hair color. It was the same dynamic. It was the same psychology. It was the same everything. And I think that we have to look at, you know, when we're moving along, whether or not we want to be married or live together or you know, whatever, to take a look at our own dynamic and the past relationship histories that we've been involved in, and you know, what has, you know, is there a common kind of a thread? You know, are we actually, you know, entering relationships with the same kind of a person who just maybe looks different, and, you know, who maybe, you know, has a different family background, or who's of a different religion? Because we do tend to repeat histories over and over and over again. And, you know, I'm all about just trying to examine our own role in, you know, what has worked, what has not worked, what kind of changes do we need to make so that we are going to then not be engaging in destructive and self-sabotaging relationships. I mean, we have a lot of work to do ourselves as women, as individuals. Do you not think?
Yeah, of course. No, I do. I think if you don't learn something from a breakup, then what are you really doing? Why are you even bothering? I think that sometimes in the aftermath of a breakup is where you do your most, you know, radical self-reflection. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And if you're not doing that after a divorce or a big breakup, then you're really missing out, honestly. I've never felt so transformative and that the possibilities were so endless. Never more than right after my biggest relationship ended. So I completely agree with you there.
Well, I think that we all need to do a lot more self-reflection. You know, I'm updating my book right now, and I was just, you know, referring to a case history of a woman that I actually treated in Sarasota. And she had been married for a number of years. It was a very abusive relationship, not physically, but emotionally. And he was controlling and pretty disgusting. So we worked together, and she filed for divorce, which was really a wonderful, wonderful thing that she was able to, you know, get the chutzpah, get the confidence, and do what was in her best interest. So a few months afterwards, she came in for a session, and she told me that she'd really met this great guy on Longboat Key Beach, and she was very excited, and it was wonderful and terrific. And a couple of months later, she decided that she was going to get married. Now, she knew absolutely nothing about this man, who, by the way, was married, and was really not interested. She didn't learn. She learned apps. She jumped from a really bad situation into another potentially really, really bad situation. He told her all kinds of stories about Swiss bank accounts and all kinds of degrees, and that he'd been living in Europe and he didn't have all the necessary documents that he was able to, you know, show her and verify a lot of things that he said. So they ended up getting married. And she was furious with me, just furious that I wanted her to, you know, take some time and do a really, really good in-depth assessment. But, you know, loneliness and neediness and just wanting to be in love and being lost and all of that, that just, that, you know, it overrided any real common sense. And that was the end of that. So what I have found is that many people don't learn anything from, you know, their relationship woes and difficulties. And of course, it's always about lessons to be learned. What have we learned? And, you know, with the high divorce statistic, most of these divorces now, according to studies, are being initiated by women. So that's a real change. And I think it's a really positive change that if it's not working, if it's not good, if it can't be, you know, resolved, you know, to a greater degree, that women are no longer staying, for the most part, as they did in the past.
Oh, yeah, that all makes sense to me. And like I said, I think the number one thing is don't end a relationship without learning something. Don't go right from one relationship to the other without really assessing what you want. I mean, I think that's that's like feminist advice and non-feminist advice just for happiness.
Good advice.
What is feminism about if not happiness, you know?
No, exactly. And, you know, your friends, you're in your 20s, right?
Say it again?
You're in your 20s, right?
I'm 35, actually.
You're 35. my husband thought that you were young. Okay, so women who are in their mid-30s, are most of your friends, are they in relationships? Are relationships important to them? Are they?
Yes. I think most people, relationships are important to them. I do have a lot of friends who are in committed relationships, and some of them have children. And then I have some friends who are single my age. Most of the single people do not want to be single, especially the women that I know. But I think the underlying vibe of, like, the several women who are close to me who I know who are single are just, like, they don't want to settle for some guy that they don't love. Or for some women or some of them are queer, you know?
Right, right.
I think that in some ways that's good. In other ways, I do see how the dating market favors certain people over other people. That's definitely been extremely clear to me as I've become older. I mean, not that 35 is that old, but there's a real difference in terms of what you're looking for between 25 and 35, and a lot of people I know are looking for more serious partners. But then there's a section of my friends who aren't looking for more serious partners and know that they just, like, lighter, more fun relationships are all they're capable of. It's actually kind of all over the map. But I do feel like the single people feel a little left behind at this crucial moment where older millennials are settling down and having children. That said, I run with a pretty educated crowd, and as you probably know as a sex therapist, the more educated you are, the more likely your long-term relationship is going to work out. So my personal experience might be rather skewed, you know?
Mm-hmm. So are you optimistic about what we are certainly all trying to do with the Me Too movement and with feminism as we are really moving forward?
It's hard to say. I mean, I am an optimistic person, and I do feel that this conversation has been extremely edifying for a lot of people who have their hearts in the right place and may have not known sort of the pervasiveness of low-grade harassment and abuse and things that not everybody would agree are even bad, again, with the Aziz Ansari thing. Mm-hmm. That said, I think there is a small portion of people, especially men, but not only limited to men, that are fighting back harder than ever to sort of retain the status quo. And it's scary, and it's a real double down. I'm talking about anyone from Donald Trump, who will openly mock rape victims, to just a random, you know, incel on the internet who really feels very strongly about how they've been screwed over by women. And
right.
There's just a lot of anger that have come out of this new sexual revolution, which I feel like it really is the beginning of another sexual revolution. There's this concept of sort of like men, like most men sort of wanting to learn and wanting to be part of it, and then a segment of men really refusing to participate and sort of going their own way and really digging in their heels. That makes me sad, but I think overall it's optimism.
Well, no, that's really good to hear, and I think that the Me Too movement, I mean, it's really been such a powerful when you think about, you know, women. I was on, you know, Gretchen Carlson's show a couple of years ago before the fiasco with Fox. And I mean, look at what she was able to do. And, you know, Jim and I, we've been watching The Loudest Voice. I don't know whether you've been catching it on HBO, which is about Roger Ailes. And,
oh, I heard of it. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. Russell Crowe, he needs to get an Emmy, you know, for his performance.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
But what was going on behind closed doors, and maybe not even so much behind closed doors, you know, at Fox, and what it took for, you know, for Gretchen to be able to come out. And, you know, she brought down Roger Ailes. She brought down Bill Shine. Whether or not the culture at Fox is changed, I mean, that's, you know, who knows? Probably not. But, you know, more and more women, and it's a wonderful thing, are saying enough is enough. And there's more and more support for, you know, for coming out now and trying to not allow and encourage and enable these men to go about their business as usual. So I feel a lot more optimistic about things today than I would have said 10 or 15 years ago. I think that I think we're on the right track. With lots more work that we have to do.
I think we're on the right track, too, and I especially think we're on the right track professionally. I mean, I know there's a lot of noise about men being so afraid of doing the wrong thing and blah, blah, blah. But I think that's
right.
Really just more like growing pains than anything else, and I think most men know how to conduct themselves and will be able to conduct themselves. And all these facetious complaints of being afraid of doing anything and talking to women, female colleagues, I think that's a short-term problem. I think the more long-term progress is already underway in the workplace. I think we have a lot more to go when it comes to personal relationships. But in terms of the workplace, certain things just aren't going to be acceptable anymore. And I think that that's great.
No, I think it's great too. Well, listen, Nona, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. And I really do want to meet you in person. We'll have to set up a time to meet and give your father our love. And again, thank you so very much for being on the Ask Beattie Show. We'll talk soon.
Thanks so much, Bea. It was a real pleasure.
Okay. Yes, it was. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that was Nona Willis-Aronovich, a really, really terrific young woman. And she sounded to have a very balanced view of things. But I am still maintaining, again, not blaming the women, not blaming the victims, but that when it comes to our personal relationships, we really, really do need to do a much better job in educating ourselves. I don't want to wait for other people to make it right for me. Although the two, of course, are not mutually exclusive at all, I think we do need to have a much, much clear view of what healthy relationships are and what healthy relationships are not, and that we have to be willing if we need to get some help to be able to become more empowered, to be able to become more more assertive, to be able to learn how to say no more, then so be it. But that we need to make sure that we are in a really, really good place so that when things start to get off track in our relationships, whether or not it's our personal relationships, whether or not it's our political relationships, whether or not it is our family relationships, that we know when we start to feel that things are starting to get crazy, that we are not going to stand back, that we're going to take the power or learn to get the power if we've never felt or if we've never had the power, so that we are not going to allow people to walk over our personal space and our personal boundaries regardless. And of course, it's easier said than done if you're relying on a boss where you're needing your salary to pay your rent and to put food on the table for your children. Things get a lot more dicey. But I'm really hoping, and I'm also like Nona Willis-Aronovich, I'm optimistic about the future. I think that things have, you know, really been shaken up a lot, which is a really, really good thing, whether or not we're talking about bottoming out in therapy or bottoming out on the workplace or bottoming out in other aspects of our lives, that where it is an opportunity. And this is how I've always seen it, that crises, if we open our eyes to the possibilities, to the potential of what we can do in a crisis situation, we can really make a lot of positive changes in our life, and we can break. We have the power, whether or not you're a man, whether or not you're a woman, to break the self-destructive pattern in our relationships across the board, and end up in situations where we are empowered and where we're able to really enjoy healthy relationships. And of course, that's one of the primary reasons why I love to do the Ask Beady show, because I do. I hope that every single week that I'm going to say some little thing where you're going to have an aha moment and maybe realize the situation that you're in, that you have the power to change it. So everybody, an hour has come and gone here again on the Ask Beady show. I want to thank you all for listening, for texting, for downloading the Ask Beady show in the Progressive Radio Network archives.